The recording now. Okay. Welcome to the Sunday night There is a Solution newcomer and returning member meeting of Overeaters Anonymous. Visit our website at oaontario.org, where you'll find this audio recording, additional podcasts, and a place to donate to keep this special service active. The opinions expressed are those of individual OA members and do not represent OA as a whole. We will now introduce our speaker, a member who has at least 6 months of abstinence, has recovered through the directions in the Big Book, and maintains recovery on a daily basis. After the share, there will be a time to make comment or ask a question about the OA program or what the speaker has shared. Please help me welcome Nancy P. from Massachusetts, a compulsive overeater.
Hi, thank you, Donna, for inviting me, or whoever invited. I got an email, a text, but thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here. My name is Nancy P. I'm a recovered compulsive overeater of the hopeless variety. I just had that conversation today with somebody. So, you know, what I was like was, you know, a shrieking harpy. I was a yelling mother when my kids were little, to my everlasting shame. There wasn't a fight that I didn't love. In fact, I wasn't happy unless I could get in a fight, an argument, especially with a bank or an insurance company, and if somebody cried, that was icing on the cake. I felt as though something was satisfied when I was in attack dog mode. And I was just burdened by it. I was always mad. And even when I was glad, I was mad, because I was still sort of suffering under this yoke of unhappiness, and it never went away, ever. And of course, I tried to make it go away by eating it away. And I tried to make it go away by weighing and measuring it away. And neither of those worked. And it didn't matter what I did in my life to make it go away. It just never worked. And, you know, I spent a lot of time, you know, I've been in OA since I was 11. I'm 62. That's 51 years. And I never got it, you know, up in my brain. I never, you know, if you learn something in school, or you don't understand, then the teacher spends a few extra minutes and explains, and they say, oh, now I get it. I never got it. I never understood it. And, you know, I'm really agnostic, like I'm super duper wicked agnostic. And I didn't embrace that for a long time. All I saw in the meetings were these mostly women, but some men that were really into the whole thing about God. And, I never could get there, and I tried hard, and I didn't try for 10 minutes. I didn't even try for 10 months. I tried for more than 10 years, you know, 30 years to get it. Fake it till you make it. That's, you know, the talks about, I'm just going to go freeform here. You know, Bill says the four terrible horsemen of terror, frustration, bewilderment, and despair. I think the four terrible horsemen for Nancy P are fake it till you make it, act as if, borrow mine, and use the group. In terms of getting the spiritual nature, because everybody defines that as this root of this God root, and everything springs, you know, branches out from that like the tree of life. And I couldn't get it. And I'm pretty smart. You know, I'm well read and articulate. I think I'm respectful of other people's opinions, except when they're wrong. you know, I just couldn't get it. And that almost killed me. I couldn't get it. Because in order to recover, I had to get over that. I call it the God hump. So I'll go back a little bit and say, you know, I was really only a little girl in fourth grade when I joined OA. And, you know, my mother, who was a member, she had been a member since I was six. And she and all her dumb OA friends decided that all their kids should be in OA. So they, you know, got this young people's meeting together. And it was kind of a disaster for me. I mean, it was kind of a disaster because nobody understood, you know. We just, you know, we tried, you know. But I went to, then that didn't work, so I went to the, like, the adult meetings. And that didn't work too well either. But I still went. And then by the time I got into high school, Owe was a little older, and I was a little older, and, you know, I could, there were more people my age, you know, there were people my age or a little older, you know, maybe in, when I was a teenager, they were in their 20s. So I could kind of identify with them in terms of, you know, life experience or life outlook on life. You know, I wasn't like a, you know, a matron, and neither were they, you know, like the women that started were all had kids and all were married with several children. And, you know, but meanwhile, the rest of my life was kind of a disaster. I had, you know, the public and the private. And the private, you know, the secret Nancy P was going out, boozing it up and drugging it up with my friends. And then, you know, who were not my friends, they were just my drinking and drugging buddies. But then I had my real friends, who were also not really my friends, were my eating buddies. And we, you know, we would eat, and my best friend, who's still my, well, she's like my oldest friend. She's still my very, very good friend, very good friend. You know, she's 2 years older than me. And I remember she lived at home when she was in college because she was paying for her own freight, so she couldn't afford to live away. And then I went to college, and we were talking on the phone. She said, "I really miss you." And I said, "Oh, I miss you too," which I did miss her. But I was having this awesome time at college, so I didn't miss her too much, and or as much as she missed me. And then when we talked again on the phone, she said, "You know what? Like, we used to go out, and, you know, she was not into drugs, but she would drink, and I would drink, and we would eat." And one day she called me up. She said, "You know what?" She said, I get sick and tired of all the drinking, and I, you know, and I quit smoking, and I was getting fat, so I went on a diet, and I'm listening, I'm like, "That's great, you know, good for you, and, you know, that's good, you know," it's like being a friend, you know. She said, "You know what?" She said, "I've lost 14 pounds. That conversation happened 42 years ago, I remember, and she has still never gained that weight back. Unlike me, who's gone up and down and diet workshop, Weight Watchers, you know, those are a few of the outside methods that I tried, all while going to OA, because like I said, it never stopped going since I was 11, but it took a while for it to sort of, you know, smooth out the rough edges. But inside the program, while I was going to meetings, actively, you know, holding offices or, you know, like venue getter, speaker seeker, treasurer, you know, all these things, the methods that I tried to get a grip on it were more meetings, fewer meetings, different meetings, eat this, don't eat that, don't eat this, weigh and measure, don't weigh and measure, eat sugar, don't eat sugar, and, you know, read more literature, you know, try, you know, AWOLs. I went into the 90-day community for a little while, luckily only a little while, and nothing worked. And my favorite one was to get a sponsor, the meaner the better. Like if I sneezed instead of coughed, she'd drop me, you know. And like they were, you know, one sponsor that I had said, "I'm in charge of your food and this is what you're going to eat." And I was like, "This is great." And I lost weight until I picked up. And, you know, I called her up and I told her, and she's like, "Okay, you can't go to the AWOL anymore. That had an abstinence requirement." And, you know, like that, you know, that just, I don't need anybody's help to feel bad about myself. And so, you know, if a sponsor's going to treat me that way, that was not good for me. And so, you know, again, up and down, up and down. I got pregnant with my first child, who's pushing 22. He'll be 22 next month. Can't believe it. I gained 100 pounds in that pregnancy. And, you know, occasionally, going to OA meetings, actually. I was very pregnant, still going to OA meetings, but gained 100 pounds. I lost 94 and a half of it, and I got pregnant with my second child. And through dint of sheer will and white knuckling, I only gained 70 pounds in that second pregnancy. And then I lost all that and gained it all back. And, I mean, you know, up and down, up and down. And, you know, I had a sponsor once, and I called her up and I said, I picked up, and she said to me, just in this tone of voice, she goes, "Why?" Why do you do it? And I thought to myself, well, I'm a compulsive overeater. That's what I do. But she was all about abstinence. And so, you know, that's sort of what I was like. And like I said, I was at the, I had a hair trigger temper, and the, my favorite thing to do, like I said, was to get in a good fight with someone from a bank or an insurance company. And, you know, I don't know, you know, in my, my personal relationships, the men that I went out with, I have a, I grew up on a, in a house where the front walk was made of flagstones. And if you lifted them up, they were like bugs. Like, and that's where the men that I dated, that's where they lived. Like, if you lifted up a flat rock, that's where they'd be, like, you know, sliming out to take all my money and cheat on me. And my two most significant relationships were one with a guy that was for sure absolutely going to end up hitting me, and the other one was with a guy that was on parole from a maximum security prison in Florida, two counts, 25 and 5 for drugs. Now, I'm not saying that people like that don't deserve awesome wives, but I wasn't raised to go out with convicted felons, you know. I just wasn't. And here I am going, I thought I was going to marry each of those guys. And, you know, I don't really believe in, I don't not believe in God, but the only reason I'm not an atheist is because I might be wrong. So, you know, for sure. Okay, for sure I was going to end up with someone like that, them or someone like that. But somebody else decided, no, that's not what's going to happen. I'm just going to turn on the light here because I can't even see anybody. Sorry, everyone. All right, that's better. So, you know, the guy that I did end up with has more integrity in his pinky fingernail than I could ever hope to have. He's a wonderful father. He's a wonderful husband. I just came back from Europe. I was gone for 3 weeks. He's a wonderful, wonderful guy. He's European born, so not as uncommon as one might think. But anyways, I cannot imagine, like, how lucky, you cannot imagine how lucky I feel to be married to him. And, but again, you know, I'd think that I'd have it. I'd say, oh, this is the silver bullet. I was always looking for a silver bullet, right? Eat this, don't eat that. Oh, all I have to do is never eat that. Or all I have to do is always eat this. Or all I have to do is get this sponsor. And that never worked. And, you know, I sort of, it talks about how, you know, career is something, is a position in life that offers the opportunity for advancement, but it also means to move in an uncontrolled direction, swiftly in an uncontrolled direction. And that's what I did. I careered from one catastrophe to another. When I was in high school, I got in a car accident every weekend for 2 months, and I totaled each of my parents' cars twice, and for example. And I thought, nothing going on here, you know, ain't it grand, the wind stopped blowing, you know, like that. Like, I didn't understand. You know, I graduated from college. I couldn't get a job. It was in the middle of a horrible recession. And, and, you know, and then I got a job. I got fired from several jobs in my career. And I still didn't think anything was wrong. Then we had a family catastrophe, which was that my daughter, my younger child, started cutting and burning herself. And I could not eat fast enough. And trust me, I know how to eat. And I was eating all the time. If I wasn't working, which wasn't even a, you know, sometimes I'd be working with food at my desk, sleeping or actively with my family, I was eating. And I was howling with fear and pain and rage, and I mean howling with it. I couldn't eat fast enough. Every morning I would stop at Dunkin' Donuts and buy a dozen donuts, my morning dozen donuts, and I would tear off a piece in the car, half of it, and swallow it whole like a dog. And my throat hurt from eating like that. It was awful. And one day I was sitting in my car, sobbing, waiting to pick her up from school. And I called a friend that I've known for 45 years and who's in program. And she said, Nancy, I haven't talked to you in so long. And I said, well, I hope we're still friends. She said, you know, yeah, of course. And she got me in touch with A Vision for You, which many of you of us, all of us have heard of. And she said, oh, you've got to call. And I said, all I said was phone meeting. That's all I said. But she heard what I was thinking, which is I'm not going to an effing phone meeting. Like, F that. They all suck and you suck and they suck and I'm never going. She heard my thinking. She said, no. This one's different. I promise. And I wrote down the number. I said, okay, give me the number. I said, give me the website. She said, no, get a piece of paper, write it down. I'll wait. My hands were covered with my afternoon dozen donuts, sugar and frosting and donut and everything. And I took a piece of paper out of my sticky purse with a sticky pen, and I wrote it on in the middle of my sticky steering wheel, and I called in December 1st of 2017, you know, and I have not had to pick up food. I have not had to hurt myself with food since that day. But what I really think is that whatever it is that takes care of me heard me sobbing in my car and said to the other ones having coffee, you know what, I think this one's had enough. I think I'm going to pluck her back from the gates of death and set her on the right path. And, you know, I had Bill's story. No words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. That's where I was. And what that really represented to me was that's when I surrendered. Now, I'm all about surrender. That's the only thing that I care about. I mean, I care about other things, but that's the main thing that I service in my program is my recovery, is my surrender. And but so surrender didn't do me any good until I did something with it. So, you know, like I said, I dialed in and I've not had to hurt myself with food, but I didn't get a sponsor, a vision sponsor until maybe, I don't know, 5 or 7 or 8 days later. And, you know, I listened and I said, maybe her. Finally, I get one. And she's no nonsense. She's not my friend. I wouldn't pick her for a friend. She's not like me at all, but she's a kick-ass sponsor and she knows the book inside out, I'll tell you. And, you know, our conversations went ring, ring, ring. Hello. Hi. How are you? Fine. Where were we? We never talked about anything social, almost ever. In the 3 months that it took us, 3 months plus or minus a week or so, she never asked me about my daughter. Never. She knew about it because, you know, I told her talked about it in my fourth step, and before we started working together, I told her a little bit about what was going on with me. Never asked me about that, which was fine. That actually was exactly what I needed because people, you know, like, I call her my real sponsor because I've talked to the woman that I talk to every day on the phone for 35 years, 38 years now, because I've been recovered for a while. So I still talk to her on the phone, but she's like my friend. She's, you know, oh, that's okay. You know, I didn't need that. And so I went through the steps and she would say occasionally, any questions or comments? And I always said, nope. And the reason that I didn't have any questions or comments is because I had flapped my jaw my entire life. You know, I felt like I was special because I had this mother who was a co-founder of OA on the East Coast. I mean, she was the one that answered the ad that Bernice put in the paper. And together, the two of them sort of polluted the entire East Coast of the United States with Overeaters Anonymous. So I felt, you know, kind of special. Kind of like I should just know it because why wouldn't I, right? I mean, you know, why shouldn't I? But nothing changed inside up here. I was just always mad. And, you know, I began to recover. You know, I did what I was told immediately and as hard as I could. If she said to do something, I did it. If I didn't know how, I'd only call her back and say, after I failed, maybe I didn't do that right. What do you think? She wasn't like sympathetic to me. She had her own family issues that were, I can tell you, hard. And so, but she took me through the steps and she forced me. I mean, I was a very willing subject student, but she forced me to look at these steps and do them without exception. And like immediately, and it's hard. That's what I tell people when they call me. And I'll tell you that on page 52, I'm just going to get my book and read it. I have four pages in the book that are like my favorite page. I mean, every page has something to recommend it. But I have this, It says, when we saw others solve their problems by a simple reliance upon the spirit of the universe, we had to stop doubting the power of God. That is not my favorite sentence here, because I don't really care about the power of the universe, and I dislike the word God. It says, but here it is. Our ideas did not work, but the God idea did. And my note to myself says, this could actually work for me too. Like, I'm not special. And I tell people that all the time. I mean, just to soften the blow, I say, you know, they'll call me up and they'll say, blah, 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 blah. And I'll say, I said, you're not special. There's nothing about you that's not going to work if you do these things the way that they tell you to do them in the book. And the reason I know that is because I'm not special. Because if one of us was going to be, it would totally be me. That's what I say to them. Because, you know, to make them laugh a little bit. And that's what I thought, is it might work for me too. And then, you know, when we agnostics, which is, see, this opened right up to this book, right up to this page. My favorite page in the whole book is page 47. Because I knew that if I was going to get this thing, if I was going to understand it and recover and get better, I had to get over the God hump. I had to do that. And my sponsor said on page 47, she said, you have to decide, what do you want God to do, be, and what do you want God to do for you? And I thought to myself, you know, I was single-minded in my pursuit of recovery. Like, nothing got in my way. One night, my husband and I were taking my daughter to an emergency CBAT, community-based acute treatment center. This is like 6:30 at night, 45 minutes down there, an hour there, 45 minutes back, would have put us almost around the time when I was supposed to talk to my sponsor. I brought my big book in the car with me in my cell phone, and I texted her, and I said, this is what's going on, but I'll still be able to call you. I didn't care if my husband was in the car. I didn't care. I don't care. I still don't care. You know, who hears what I say? I don't care. And she got back to me and said, you know, take care of your family. Don't worry about it for tonight. I mean, nothing got in my way. Nothing. Still nothing gets in my way. And so I said to myself, I have to get over this God hump. I have to. And she said, you know, when she said, what do you want God to be and what do you want God to do for you? I said, I'm going to take that challenge. What do I want? What do I want? Like, I don't like the cross, the crescent, or the star. Those don't work for me. I was raised in a observant means a certain orthodoxy to me, but I was raised in a house that was respectful of my religion. You know, I was appropriately religiously educated, and, you know, my parents did the best that they could. And so, you know, but I didn't like that. It didn't work for me. I was never got any comfort from it. It just made me feel like I was wearing a pair of shoes that was a half a size too small and an itchy sweater, both at the same time. So that wasn't going to work. And so I said to myself, I'm going to take everything that I've ever learned, was told, heard, wrote, read, was near, imagined, everything about God, and chuck it out the window. And then I thought to myself, okay, what can I embrace? And I said, the first thing is not God. I don't like that word. It doesn't make me feel connected to anything. I don't feel serene. Chuck it. Okay, good. Second thing, no knees. Wasn't raised that way. Doesn't make me feel comfortable, connected. The only thing I feel closer to is the floor. And I don't need to be closer to my musty carpets or see the dust bunnies under my bed. Okay, chuck that too. No God, no knees. And then I said, well, you could spend a month saying what you don't want. How about what you do want? And that's when I really thought about what can I embrace. And I thought of it like I was building a swing set. You know, 8 or 10 tubey pipey things and 40 million nuts, screws, and bolts. And I thought, well, one thing that I can embrace is trust. There's nothing offensive about that. And this is on my way home from work. So this whole process took 10 minutes, maybe 12 minutes. And I thought, okay, trust, compassion, and kindness. And again, it took my two tubey pipey things, bolted them together, and said, I can live with that. There's nothing offensive. And then I said, you know, sympathy, compassion, empathy, friendliness, you know, to continue to build. And every once in a while I'd think about, you know, I'd jump on the swing set, see if it could hold my weight, invite the neighbor kids over for a metaphorical pool party and jump a lot of kids. And it was holding up, you know, patience, dependability, integrity, honesty, like that. And then I thought to myself, well, you could spend a month saying this too. And so, like any good direct marketer, I sealed the deal and said, and I reserve the right to change or amend it anytime I want without notice, because I'm only selling it to myself. I'm not marketing this. This is all for me. And, you know, thus was my cornerstone set in place, and no later vicissitude has shaken it. And I will say that, you know, I'm not averse to changing. You know, I'll reach for more, but I'm not going to throw my back out, which brings me back to page 47 when it says, you know, when therefore we speak to you of God, we mean your own conception of God. This applies to other spiritual expressions which you find in this book. Okay, good. I'm with you. Do not let any prejudice you may have against spiritual terms deter you from honestly asking yourself what they mean to you. So that's what I needed to do. That's what I just described. Because you have to, what it says, at the start, this was all we needed to commence spiritual growth to affect our first conscious relation with God as we understood him. Well, the word commence means to begin. And I remember when I only had one child when he was little, I began as I meant to go on. So he was, you know, went to bed at the same time every night. You know, he got up, but, you know, I did it. I put him on a schedule, you know, what you call a schedule. And I never varied from it, pretty much. And with this, I needed to get to a place, you know, this is the key to the whole thing. Without this, without a working concept, I was never going to get any further. And so, you know, it says, if we wish to grow, we had to begin somewhere. So we used our own conception, however limited it was. But I can tell you right now, my note says, or not limited for me, my conception of this thing that takes care of me is actually the absence of limits. I don't know what it is. I don't care what it is. You know, I've sponsored people whose teeth I can hear grinding, saying, who do you surrender to? And I'm like, what do I care? As long as it works. Like in my car, if my GPS doesn't work, I don't take a wrench out and bash open the dashboard to try to fix it. I take it to the dealership or tell my husband. I mean, this is like below my radar. It's not what I do. And it says here, afterward, we found ourselves accepting many things which then seemed entirely out of reach. That word afterward means after step 11. And so what you have to do is work all of the steps exactly as they say in the book. So when I say, you know, I could only believe, when I say that, you know, no later vicissitude has shaken it, I mean it. And a vicissitude is something that serves a rocking motion. And so I have not, my simple conception of a power greater than myself has never failed me. It has never failed me. It has gotten me through, you know, we had this problem, you know, with one of my kids, as I was saying, you know, I didn't pick up so much as an extra grain of rice. And let me tell you, it was hard. It was really hard. That was really, really hard. And I'll go back to my another favorite page that I have, which is page 28, which is an awesome page. And it says, you know, here was the terrible dilemma in which our friend found himself when he had the extraordinary experience, which, as we have already told you, made him a free man. We, in our turn, sought the same escape with all the desperation of drowning men. I can actually tell you that I almost drowned once, so I know, I feel like I know what that is. And it didn't feel like I was drowning. What it felt like was I was in this horrible undertow and at the beach, like it was pulling me under. And every once in a while, I get a breath of air, and I think, I'm struggling, you know, and I'm a good swimmer. I can't seem to get my breath. And all of a sudden, three huge lifeguards were out with a rope that was tied with a metal spike into the beach to haul me out of the undertow because I was drowning. I didn't even know it. What seemed at first a flimsy reed has proved to be the loving and powerful hand of God. A new life has been given us, or if you prefer, a design for living that really works. Well, I don't like that hand of God business. So I read that as what seemed at first a flimsy reed has proved to be the loving and powerful design for living that really works. And then it says, you know, blah, 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 a multitude of ways in which men have discovered God. So my note says there are no rules on this. It says, in fact, faith can be acquired. So to me, I could probably get it on Amazon if I could figure out, you know, what words to use, the Boolean code. And then it says, if what we have learned, felt, and seen means anything at all, it means that all of us, whatever our race, creed, or color, are the children of a living creature with whom we may form a relationship upon simple and understandable terms as soon as we are willing and honest enough to try. So religion is a convenient path, but it's not the only one. And, you know, I live right down, right a mile away from Route 95. It goes from Florida to, from Maine to Florida. So if I want to go to New York, I can jump on 95. It's 200 miles away, and I'll get there in 4 hours, maybe. But I could also, you know, go to Maine first and then go. I could fly to L.A. I could go to China and then go to New York. The book says I can do it any way I want. And it says, you know, those having religious affiliations will find here nothing disturbing to their beliefs or ceremonies. There is no friction among us over such matters. And my note to myself says there is also no, those with no religious affiliation will also find here nothing offensive to their beliefs or lack of beliefs and ceremonies. So I had to take, you know, the road of happy destiny, the spiritual highway has, you know, on-ramps and off-ramps, but they're all religious. Like all religions say the same thing. Come with us, do what we do, and we'll keep you safe on the road of life. We'll keep you out of scary neighborhoods, off of dark corners and broken pavement. Just come with us. That didn't work for me. So I had to take a spiritual machete and bushwhack my way and blast my way onto the spiritual highway. But once I did that, like once I said, nothing is going to get in my way, it worked. That's what I can say. And so in the 10th, you know, so then you go through these, you know, these great steps. And I'll say one, you know, I don't even know where I am, but in the 10th step, it says, this is, I go over this all the time with people that call me about this. Let's see, page 80. Oh yeah. This thought brings us to step 10. And what are the thought? The promises of step 9. And what it says is, we suggest that we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any mistakes as we go along. So, okay, that's good. I can do that. There's no talking involved yet. We vigorously commence this way of living. Vigorously means life-giving. As we cleaned up the past, we have entered the world of the spirit. Still no talking. Our next function is to grow. Growing means to get from immature to mature. In understanding and effectiveness. Okay, I'm on board. No, still no talking. This is not an overnight matter, which is really lucky for me, because if it was, I'd be screwed.
That's this time, Nancy.
Oh, sorry. Let me just wrap up. You know, basically, it should continue for my lifetime, and it has. And today, I can say that I work on my surrender as hard and as much as I worked on my eating. In other words, if I'm not sleeping, working, or actively with my family, I'm doing something to bolster my recovery. I do it all the time. And even though I do it all the time, my life is packed full of wonderfulness and fantasticness and awesomeness. From the minute I wake up until the minute I go to bed, I'm busy, I'm happy, I'm joyous, I'm free. And today, I go where free men go. I do what free men do. I have no limitations. And I'll just say take one more minute. When we were in Scotland, my husband, his retina became detached. And I was not nervous about that at all. I didn't say anything other than to ask the doctor if he was actually old enough to practice medicine, which I can be forgiven because he actually did look pretty young. But I said nothing. I was confident. And I had visited a program friend. I went a week earlier than my family, and she texted me. She said, "How's your husband's eye?" And I said, "We are both being well taken care of." I mean, miracles upon miracles upon miracles. He got surgical care there that saved his sight. I wasn't sitting on my anger and just not saying anything. I was truly free. My feelings don't own me anymore. And so that's what I have to say. So that'll pass.
Thank you so much, Nancy. What a